So intellectually and morally, people from the cognitive sciences have turned everything we know about the Enlightenment, everything we know, even everything we know about medicine, upside down. First, do no harm. Now you get climate psychologists, clinical psychologists and psychiatrists saying we must go and upset people.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReports.com, in a conversation that's coming to you being recorded on the 8th of April, 2024. And although I am often the bearer of bad news and talking about depressing and horrible things that are going on in the world, it is one of my rare joys in life to be able to bring to my audience's attention, well, I won't say new writers, but at least new to the audience, potentially. And today will be no exception to that. I'm going to be talking to Mr. Ben Pyle of the Net Zero Scandal Substack. He also has a website, climatedebate.co.uk. He is a writer at The Daily Skeptic. And we're going to be talking about, well, a very specific article that he has written recently on a subject that I know intersects with subjects that are interesting in my world, and I'm sure to the regular viewers of the Corbett Report audience, specifically his recent article at The Daily Skeptic, Behavioral Scientists Aren't Just Wrong About How to Win Over Electorates to Crackpot Progressive Policies. Their evident contempt for the masses has contributed to the global populist revolt, which is quite a mouthful, but quite a good description of that article. On that note, as I say, I have only recently discovered Ben Pyle and his writings, but I will definitely direct people towards some of them that I find fascinating and that could be the subject of conversations in and of themselves. For example, a recent article on the Rash of Carney, talking about the former Bank of England and Bank of Canada governor, who is now apparently advising the Labour Party on climate policy. Also, a very interesting article on the unofficial official ideology of British institutions, which goes some way towards very factually laying out and eviscerating the ideological narrative being portrayed by the BBC and the Royal Society about capitalism and environmentalism. Also, an excellent 20-minute compendium video called Why There Is No Climate Crisis, which it contains a lot of inconvenient facts that the Extinction Rebellion crowd would probably rather you not know about. So I will, of course, link up all of those in the show notes. But here to talk about his most recent article, let's bring on Ben Pyle. Ben, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here and to meet you at last.
Yes, excellent. Well, as is my wont, since you're the first, this is your first time on the Corbett Report, why don't you introduce yourself to us? Who are you? Where do you come from? Why are you writing about these subjects?
Oh, yeah. So, thanks very much. That's a huge question. And I should point out first, I didn't write that title. I wrote the article. I didn't write the title of that really long piece. Actually, it's probably getting on for probably the longest title of anything I've ever done. And I used to get accused of writing 800 words where 80 would do. And so that's that sort of effort. I guess started about 20, maybe 17 years ago in the late 2000s. And we were, I and a writing partner, we picked up some problems with the climate narrative, so to speak, as it was sort of then. And we decided we'd sort of capitalize on that. We'd invest our time in that and write about these problems that we perceived. And that was the climate change had sort of almost descended to science to climate science in particular. And we thought there was a lot more to be said about what the ideology of environmentalism was and the extent to which that had been established in the academy, I suppose, and in politics, without this sort of attention that would have normally been drawn by ideological movements in their ascendancy to occupy as it is the case in Britain, the corridors of power. But Britain's, I take the view that environmentalism is an ism like any other ism, the isms that characterized the early to mid 20th century, and that they're seeking a pretty radical, far-reaching transformation of society. So notwithstanding the science, we should take it on that basis. We should take it at face value. They're clear about it. They say it. They want to change society. And so we say, okay, well, what kind of world do you want? And how do you want to go about changing that world? And of course, part of that program, if you like, part of that agenda involves recruiting the likes of climate psychologists intervening in the climate debate in very much the way I would argue, or maybe it's ameliorated somewhat, very much following the role that psychologists had in the Soviet Union, if I can put it that strongly, and perhaps other tyrannies. A lot of people were using science at the time, climate science, as a club to beat people around the head and sort of require their obedience and their submission. And to exclude them from debates, and that in itself, whether or not CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and whether greenhouse gases are causing global warming, and whether or not global warming is causing climate change, that needs to be interrogated. A lot of people from within the academy and so-called civil society really are hostile to the principle that ordinary people with or without expertise, and people who are not part of, the ivory towers of the academy, they don't think that such people should be able to influence political decisions. So that's where we started from. And then that's rolled on over the last 20 years. Most people have probably ignored my efforts. The net zero is in full swing here. I can't claim to have changed the debate yet. But that's because most people haven't yet had to experience what net zero really means for them. As I put it, no pain, no campaign. It wasn't until recently that people really felt the effects of high prices, and so things are changing now. The mood of the debate has radically changed in the last few years. So that's created opportunities to do more stuff. Been writing for Spiked for most of the duration, and now writing for Daily Skeptic, and producing more videos and criticisms of the agenda.
Well, you raise there, I think, two of the important intertwined aspects of what we're talking about today. One is the haughty elitist attitude of the would-be rulers of society and directors of society, the social engineers who wish to manipulate the masses, and how out of touch they really are, but also the growing backlash to that is forming now that the net zero campaign is really starting to impinge on people's everyday lives. So in order to set the table for this conversation, to get a handle on this article, I was thinking, what is the best way to introduce this to the audience? And it struck me, why not start at the beginning? So with that amazing brainstorm out of the way, let me just read the opening paragraph to this article, because I think it sets the table in a good way. Nothing strikes as much fear through the establishment's fact-checkers and hate vanquishers as the rise of populism. Democratic backlashes against dominant ideologies and policy agendas are the natural and inevitable reaction to the intransigence of those who advance them. These reactions, which look likely to sweep many populist parties to power in elections this year, are seen by incumbents as the reemergence of dark historical forces. But our leaders have no other words for the challenges to their authority than far right. The reason they cannot grasp what's really going on, indeed one of the causes of their unpopularity, is that they've placed too much faith in what has turned out to be really bad science. And it strikes me that there are perhaps two candidates for that really bad science that they've misplaced their faith in. But why don't you lay it out for us? What bad science are you referring to there?
Yeah, I'm talking about the cognitive and behavioral sciences, like this idea that you can understand people's psychology and then intervene to elicit their obedience, nudge, essentially, at its most basic level, nudge, right? And then nudge comes to shove, you know, like there's nothing as frustrated as someone who thought that they could, you know, convince you, and they march into a debate thinking that they're going to come out of the room having convinced you to surrender all your belongings and so on and so forth, and going away empty handed. But this seems to be the pattern of psychology's relationship with the government in Britain. You know, it's very successful, perhaps, at convincing politicians that they have this software or this technology that can change the mindsets of the masses. But it doesn't seem to capture many people's beliefs outside of those outside of that sphere. The classic example that I refer to in the article, the sort of go-to demonstration of the success of nudge is that if you paint a little fly in the corner of the urinal, or not necessarily not the corner, because you want people to be accurate, then they take more care not to spill anything on the floor, right? But it turns out, who knew, that policy making and politics, which involves the balancing of myriad different interests and constituencies, is a little bit more complicated than peeing. And so these insights which nudges offer may have some application in some extremely sort of prosaic, limited spheres of activity. But they've told government that they can transform the public's perception at large, right? You know, of these things in order for them to accept these radical anti-democratic policy interventions. So it looks like snake oil, and it smells like snake oil, and all the people who peddle it look like snake oil merchants. So I came from that kind of position of skepticism of this, because it's very tempting to believe that there are these sophisticated techniques for controlling people's minds and what have you. And that leads to, I think, there was sort of something of a fait accompli settling in to the sort of skeptical, or what you might call the freedom movements that sort of emerged from COVID, and people really sort of thought, they've really sort of advanced this stuff. But it isn't. When nudge comes to shove, it's just fear-mongering. And it's just panic, you know. This is Greta's line: I want you to panic, right? That's not a coincidence, incidentally, that she said that the I want you to panic line comes out of a clinical psychologist's attempts to mobilize the public. Margaret Klein Salomon is her name, and she's the person credited with actually giving birth to Greta Thunberg's school strike movement and the Extinction Rebellion. As soon as the behavioral insights claims dissolve, because they're not equal to the task that they've assumed, it's just fear mongering, panic mongering, and terror, and that's just, you know, it's just bog standard. Would you call it tyranny? I don't know. I don't know what the words for it are. I think the toolbox is empty very, very quickly into the beginnings of their interventions, and they're left exhausted. And so then what happens is climate psychology just seems to turn into self-justification. It seems to let's assume some experimental evidence finds that in certain laboratory conditions, I say laboratory, you know, it's just a climate psychologist with a questionnaire and a respondent, or, you know, a series of respondents. They may say that there's sort of insight that discovers that people are 1% more likely to behave in a certain way if you present the consensus position to them, right? So that is the degree of confidence that climate psychology kind of produces its claims. It's very, you know, very small effects. And then this 1% sort of finding from climate psychology seems sufficient then to justify quite radical policy intervention, such as censorship, soft censorship, perhaps. You know, the British government is very good, for example, at setting up these sort of quangos, they're called, quasi-autonomous non-governmental organisations, that sort of serve as regulators of the public sphere with a sort of hands-off approach from government. But they're censors all the same, and the government censors all the same. So on the basis of these this kind of experimental evidence, you get these sort of draconian interventions that sort of require broadcasters to undertake particular codes of conduct when they're kind of interviewing someone who comes from the other side of the or the wrong side of a climate debate. It doesn't matter whether they're saying there's no such thing as greenhouse gas or there's no such thing as climate change. Might just be saying wind turbines are a terrible idea. You get the same treatment. And that's had a material effect on the public discussion about, or certainly the discussion in the media in the UK and probably across Europe about climate policy, but based on just wafer thin pseudo-scientific insight, and I think that's producing that's to institute a formal intransigence into the political sphere. So it's sort of like this justifies not listening to climate skeptics. No, everything you say is wrong. There's no place for you in the public debate. The debate is over. The science is settled. Go away. And that being the kind of ethic now in the British establishment and across the European Union as well, there's no dialogue between those competing interests, people who want to implement this radical environmentalist agenda, and people who are going to lose out from that, farmers. Especially people who work in industries. The industries are going to be very sensitive to high energy prices. They're not allowed into the debate. And so naturally, now people are beginning to lose out. That intransigence has produced its own reaction.
You know, you raise a number of important points there. One of which is that I think these would-be social engineers really do believe that they're these master Machiavellian manipulators who are able to fine-tune public opinion because they're masters of public psychology. But in reality, as you point out, and as you reference here in the article, I mean, it's not only the replication crisis that has pervaded all of psychology and much of science besides, but psychological science in particular, but also the known political biases within the field of social sciences have undermined what I think most people know is a lot of baloney and hoo-ha anyways. It always strikes me these types of studies that are carefully designed where they come in and they, for example, they have someone who is pro-death penalty and someone who is anti-death penalty, and they separate these groups, and then they give the pro-death penalty people facts and statistics and scientific study that shows that in fact, actually, it has no effect, the death penalty has no effect on crime rates and recidivism rates, and then they show the anti-death penalty people the exact opposite data and studies and whatever, and they're just making all of this up and they're giving it to each group. And then, as it turns out, people don't just believe anything that a scientist researcher in this laboratory setting tells them. That shows that these people have confirmation bias. Whereas, to my mind, no, it shows that people aren't gullible rubes who fell off a turnip truck yesterday and can actually identify when they are in a laboratory setting being tested on that maybe they're being lied to. You know, has that ever occurred to anyone who's set up one of these studies before? Anyway, that type of nonsense leads to this nonsense science science in which people believe, perhaps, maybe the people who are really buying the idea that this is some sort of fine-tuned master manipulation of the public consciousness and they can nudge people in whatever direction they want. The only people who are really buying this are the politicians who, speaking of confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance, are the ones who want to believe that they can do this. And so it creates this sort of self-licking ice cream cone that accomplishes nothing but makes these people feel very good about excluding, as you say, inconvenient people from this conversation, which obviously, as you point out in this article, obviously leads to the political backlash that we are seeing right now, in a way that's so obvious that I don't know how anyone could not predicted that this would be the inevitable result of this increasing intransigence of the people listening to this type of cognitive science. I have said a mouthful there. Is there anything there that you'd like to add to what my characterization there?
Yeah, and I think the dominance of sort of nominally left-wing ideology in psychological sciences. I mean, it speaks to a lot of things, but there is, it really is the case that if psychologists want to study something, I think with relation to facts and ideology and people's comprehension of science, they should really study climate psychology. Because it's a basket case, first of all. It needs the intervention of clinical psychologists. It needs someone to come and clean it up. It's if not, just get rid of the whole thing. I mean, it is a nonsense. That might sound unkind, but I remember that one of the first encounters I had with, well, I can say a couple of them actually. The first encounters I had with this field. The first was, I think, John Krosnick out of Stanford, which is this, extremely, this institution with this worldwide reputation, this fantastic, university. I'm not sure if it's Ivy League. I'm not sure how it works in the States, but nonetheless, right? He said that he sort of published this research. This is, I think, 2008, saying that if there was balance on a TV show, a news show. And they surveyed hours and hours of footage, and they showed them to hundreds of participants in studies. If there is balance in a news item on a climate question, then the public are more likely to come out of the other side questioning climate change dogma. Who knew, right? What his measure of whether someone was gave their assent or dissent to the climate consensus was whether they believe climate change is happening. It's kind of an extremely crude understanding of an extremely complicated scientific debate with many moving parts, with many different fields within it. Get from climate change, global warming science, through climate change science, through how these effects play out in the natural world and what the consequences are in the human world, through to policy. Right, it's an incredibly complex field. Or chain of reasoning, but he distills it to this one kind of thing. So, I mean, someone might see a debate between two experts and go, "Yeah, I think that climate change might not be happening is a rough approximation of my views on that question, right?" So what I'm getting at is that what John Krosnick and what the field in general does not do is examine its own understanding of climate science or the climate debate through that whole chain, as I've explained, right? They don't say what's our understanding and what can we say about climate science, climate psychology's understanding, that we can say the public have misunderstood climate science. It's very hand-wringing about what the public think, but it hasn't really examined how it is capable of speaking with authority or applying that scientific authority to the climate debate. A second one was the case, I think his name's Professor Stephen Moffick, and around the same time, 2007 or 8. And he wasn't a climate psychologist. He was a psychiatrist, a clinical psychiatrist. And he wanted, there was this article, a little video of him basically explaining that whereas psychiatry has been founded on the idea of trying to relieve the distress that people with mental health problems experience, how could psychiatrists intervene to create a level of distress in people such that they then became obedient to climate environmental imperatives? So it's like kind of this like, how can we make people feel so uncomfortable? This is nudge coming to shove, quite frankly, that they go and do as they're told. And that's like kind of so intellectually and morally, people from the cognitive sciences have turned everything we know about the Enlightenment, everything we know, even everything we know about medicine, upside down. First, do no harm. Now you get climate psychologists, clinical psychologists and psychiatrists saying we must go and upset people.
Yeah. First, make people scared.
Right.
And as you point out, there is an actual scientific pedigree to this that people point to, as you've pointed out, the Margaret Klein Salomon paper from 2016 that was specifically latched onto by the Extinction Rebellion crowd in 2018, and which has been the formation of this rebranding of what used to be known once upon a time as global warming as the climate emergency, which is apparently the way they have tried to sell it to the public, but I don't think that really worked.
Well, I remember the first Extinction Rebellion protests, and these people really believed, like the kind of Trotskyists of the 1970s, that they were going to rouse the masses from their slumber, and they were going to march through the streets to Parliament or wherever, and with millions of people behind them. They're candid about it. You can hear them. They talk about precisely this sort of idea that they were going to. One of the Extinction Rebellion co-founders, Gail Bradbrook, she talks about it openly with MPs. She says her plan was to create the understanding in the public that that climate change is the equivalent of 10 Hitlers. Right, not just one Hitler, and so this trades on this kind of this mythology of the Second World War, where British people come together and we defeat the enemy through our own sort of sheer brilliance. Never mind the complexities of the Second World War, requiring the intervention of the United States of America, Russia, and the rest of the Europe, and so on and so forth. So this idea of social cohesion can be fabricated through creating this sense of terror. It's just crap. Anyway, so the first protests that they thought were going to rouse people from the masses, they had grown men with full beards dressed up as do you have this, you know, the Girl Guides, the sort of Girl Scouting movement, Girl Guide. They were dressed up as, you know, a bunch of these sort of activists dressed up as little girls, others dressed up, you know, in fluorescent gear with the, like, kind of strange hair all that the masses saw when this protest happened was a bunch of hyper overindulged middle class people who don't have and can't have jobs, who can afford to spend weeks of their time occupying bridges in Westminster and blocking the roads to ambulances, to working people on their way to do their jobs, and so on and so forth. So it's the most alienating expression of their, you know, like the kind of, you couldn't have engineered a better two fingers shown from, you know, that class, that part of the British British society to the masses.
To my non-British listeners, two fingers might be a middle finger, the equivalent.
Yeah, right. The bird. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I know what you mean. In fact, I remember the imagery of the Vestal Virgins that they were dressing up at one of these parties that they threw. That was just, I mean, again, yes, this does not connect with the average person, but in a way, it's very appropriate because in the same way that the people who are most hurt by this agenda itself, the actual imposition of the net zero agenda, are the people on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, and the people who are most hurt by the Extinction Rebellion protests and getting people stopping average working people from going to work and earning a living are, again, the people at the bottom level of the economic pyramid. So perhaps that's oddly appropriate. But yes. Let's examine that backlash, because as you have pointed out, and which I think is perhaps the positive take on this, is that, in fact, this attempt at psychologically manipulating the masses is nothing new. It's something that I've pointed to many, many, many times before, so my regular audience will be sick of listening to it, but I'll point to it again. The opening paragraph of Edward Bernays' classic work on propaganda called Propaganda from 1928, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. At any rate, that's the ambition of these people. But with all of the might, with all of the incredible resources and that have been thrown at this, and the who knows how many billions and billions of dollars in propagandizing the public that have been spent on not just the climate agenda, but various establishment agendas over the course of this century of manipulation of the masses, you still don't have the masses buying anything that's coming out of their mouths, and in fact, at an even greater rate than before. Let's talk about the populist uprising that is happening now against the establishment.
Well, it's too soon to call, I would suggest, but the suggestions are, so I came across a poll yesterday that suggests that 50% of respondents in Germany, I think it's a fairly reliable institution, and and you'll forgive me if I've forgotten the name, but I can post it to you later. This survey of attitudes in Europe shows that 50% of people in Germany, for example, believe that the price of energy should be, i.e. lowering the price of energy should be a policy priority over meeting climate change emissions, which is a radical departure from the last 20 years of German energy policy. The Energiewende is this, you know, it's this, I think it's cost the best part of €1 trillion for the German economy. And of course, now partly as a result of fallout from the war, and of course with between Russia and Ukraine, and because of the lockdowns and the energy price crisis, a massive dose of energy realism has been injected into Germany, and this has led to the German government now consists, I think, consists of a large number of Greens. So I think Greens have formed part of the government, and that's been catastrophic. All of this stuff has been catastrophic for the energy agenda, for the climate agenda in Germany. And now it's created just this backlash. You can see in the polling. It's also sent the farmers there's a sort of bit of a farmers movement started in the Netherlands, which shows actually similar, hostility to the green agenda now. I think it's pretty close to Germany's level of, from that poll. I think it's about 48% of people now believe that the government's policy priority should be reducing costs, not reducing emissions. Throughout Europe, you're getting a lot of these people. We've had, and of course in France, we've had the yellow vests, the gilets jaunes, who were, and that was before, that was pre-COVID, and they were sparked by changes in increasing carbon emissions, putting the price of fuel up. So these are sort of like the early days. This is the beginnings of the blowback, the reaction to net zero. I say it's early days, and these haven't really turned yet, or they are turning now, I believe, into organized political movements. So there's the BBB, the farmers movement in the Netherlands, and in Germany, and the new alternative for Deutschland, AfD, or AfD, I think as you say it in German, they are now pushing the sort of parts of the sort of social democratic and soft conservative movements into second and third place in Germany. Now they're sort of occupying 20% of the polls, or winning 20% in the elections, and look like they may be rising. And so the German government is having to consider whether they're going to disenfranchise a whole fifth of the electorate and abolish this party, because it's obviously causing such a political earthquake. So of course 20% is not enough, especially in a country that has proportional representation rather than first past the post. That's never going to be enough to change the policy agenda radically in short order, but it can take the momentum out of the mainstream, what does remain as the sort of consensus between the partners of coalitions and so on. So in France, that's much more decisive, because the organized sort of radical right, I suppose you could say, the sort of Marine Le Pen, she's been sort of biding on the heels of Macron and the other sort of mainstream politicians for quite a lot longer, the far right. I think the origins of Le Pen's political movement are her father. I've forgotten his name now, so that's not very helpful. I think that part of that history can be designated as far right. It's further right than centre right. Let's put it that way. But she softened her stance, and she doesn't have quite the same preoccupations that movement had in the past. But now it looks like, certainly according to polls, that they would. Be able to form a government if the elections were held today, because people are just fed up with the establishment options that have been given to them in the form of Macron and so on and so forth. And of course, there's in Italy, with Meloni has recently. Some people believe Meloni, or even across the Atlantic, in the form of new Argentinian president. Some people think these are kind of sort of sellouts, sort of almost establishment sops, sort of put into position. But they must, it must be quite a tricky job being the president of a country that has a radically different perspective to what the rest of the international community, as it likes to call itself.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I personally don't put much stock in the political process itself and the machinations, because it is all part of that establishment machinery that will inevitably be engulfed. But what you're pointing to is, at the very least, all of these political movements are manifestations of a sea change in public opinion, general public opinion, that would have, as you point out, with regards to those German poll responses, that would have been unthinkable even a few years ago, let alone a decade or two ago. So that really represents a true change that is taking place that I think is perfectly predictable at the exact point at which the wonderful virtue signaling of, oh yes, green, that sounds good, net zero sounds wonderful, at the exact moment where that actually starts to impact people's livelihoods is the point at which they'll start rising up against it. And so I think that's a manifestation of what we're seeing. But let me just add one potential devil's advocate question here from the other side of this, because we are poo-pooing to a large extent this cognitive science and the ability of these master manipulators to manipulate the public. But let's take a look at one of the other defining master manipulative movements of the past few years, specifically, as you'll know about in the UK, the SPIB, Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Behavior, which was specifically a task force of behavioral scientists that were tasked with actually scaring the public into submission with regards to lockdowns and masking and all of that, which seems to have been remarkably successful in a large number of people in the public, at least for a couple of years. Maybe they can't maintain that momentum for very long, but they did seem to have a demonstrable effect on people's behaviors, at least in 2020, 2021. So does that speak to the other side of this, that there are cognitive behavioral scientists that can actually move the needle when it comes to public behavior and perception?
There are, I mean, there are hypotheses, although, you know, there are an analysis that sort of claim that sort of some of the shocking images and some of the shocking stories yielded a little bit more public obedience than. But you don't. But the point is, you don't need a psychology degree to understand why. If you close off all debate about what kind of problem the pandemic is, and if you only allow in the media stories about exponential curves of, you know, depicting deaths, then people believe that. People want to take institutional science at face value, in good faith, and people want to believe that the scientists, the politicians, the government is acting in good faith, and also that the opposition is acting in good faith. So, I mean, it's not psychological insight to say fear-mongering works, right? You know, so I don't know what insights SPIB and co. were really able to bring to that, other than just to justify what the government had already done to itself. Like, kind of the scaremongering was led by the likes of Neil Ferguson, and who produced these models of infinite exponential growth, so that, you know, this time next year 1500 trillion people would have died.
Everyone on the conference. How many Hitlers is that? Tell us, Neil.
so that's kind of the core, and the psych to just compare it to climate change, there's a lot of what I call consensus enforcement going on in climate psychology. So the analogous situation to the climate debate in COVID is this sort of these modeling exercises that produce, you know, radical warming, global warming feedback, and these sort of scenarios that are based on very implausible premises of, you know, everyone burns 20 tons of coal a year, and like the population increases from 8 billion people to 12 billion people, and you know, no improvements in technology made. These are the assumptions, and then those get turned into sort of consequences. It's sort of like these, they're called self-consistent storylines in the scientific literature. So these sort of animate people. And the psychologists turn up to sort of explain why that consensus, I put it in quotes if you're not watching, this consensus position needs to be defended, right? So what they say is an accurately informed public is necessary for proper decision-making, for democratic decision-making to be advanced, right, to go ahead. So the public needs to know the right thing, and the right thing are these terrible scenarios, and then so they're not fueling the debate on its own as such. They're just sort of, they're an ancillary to it. They're not the architects of the political agenda. They're just sort of servicing it, really, and they're servicing, you know, the sort of the ideological conception of the of problems like climate change and COVID, of pandemics, So, I mean, how I think it would be rash to rule out that you know that they have any impact whatsoever, right? That in especially in the situation where there's an emergency, right? So you can, once you've established fear, right? You know, you can use that to justify this, that, or the other. But as someone said, I wish I knew who. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, right? In reference to Edward Bernays, right? It's not always a penis, right? So, it would be interesting to see where these psychological insights are useful and effective. And then there should be a moral debate, about whether they should be applied or not. Like kind of, but as I say, I don't think many of the insights are very much more powerful than the instance of a fly and a urinal, a picture of a fly and a urinal. The pandemic is a frightening enough prospect until you take it to pieces and you examine what the claims are.
Right. So, a perception of a real and present emergency is necessary for this type of manipulation to have an effect. So if people do not believe in the emergency in the first place, then it is difficult to get them convinced of that. So I think one of the corollaries of what you are saying here is that when they shut down debate and they exclude people from speaking even against this agenda, then obviously they are able to have more effect in shaping the public discourse around it and getting people to comply with the various diktats. That seems to me to suggest that as long as people can hear the voice of people like myself, of yourself, of other dissenting voices out there, as long as they exist, then we have a good chance of overcoming this type of manipulation. That would also speak to the fact that, of course, as my audience will know, I had my YouTube channel scrubbed during the dark days of the pandemic because, well, I dared to speak out against it and to talk about the lockdowns and masking and all of the other insanity that was going on. So that would explain this headlong rush towards censoring and shutting down of information under the guise of disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, all of the new words that they're inventing to try to shut down the public discourse. So us speaking is part of the solution to this problem. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's what just seems to wind these psychologists up more than anything else, is that we're, you know, what are they trying to defend? And it turns out it's just the political authority of the academy. Of the campus of the university, right? And they, you know, it's telling that the only way this sort of this scientistic movement has sort of conjured up to defend itself is by reference to these emergencies, you know, like the climate change. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair even has sort of built his sort of legacy institution. It's called the Tony Blair Institute for Global Challenges, and it's very much part of this kind of WEF outlook. You know, this I don't go on about the WEF very much. I think they're mostly irrelevant, but Tony Blair is certainly not irrelevant. But it presents the future of politics as sort of governments finding ways to respond to challenges which are sort of external to politics, very much to sort of, I think, to deprive ordinary people of a role in political decision making. So you know, once you have kind of established the basis of politics as kind of risk aversion of these external, you know, about these external challenges, then you don't really, the public doesn't really need to be involved. So it's okay, we're taking care, we're mitigating the risks, we're going to save you from pollution, we're going to save you from climate change, we're going to save you from viruses and germs, and we're going to save you from Russians, and we're going to save you from yourself. Because you don't even know how to eat properly. Look at you. You're fat. You're unhealthy. You're incapable of managing your own life without being nudged through taxation, through behavioural interventions, through this, that, and the other mechanism. So it's very much this. There's the elite, the underexplored aspect of elite politics, if you like, I think, is how it's reimagined, how it reconceived the public, in order to sort of shore up its own position. I may be straying too far from the point or the question, but this requires organization institutional science to service this view of people's competences not being equal to the demands of these global challenges.
The other one was terrible. Scientists come up with the wonderful idea that we non-scientists are too stupid to understand this, so you have to leave society up to us and our management. Wow, what a self-serving idea that they've stumbled upon.
And then climate psychologists, that all the well the whole bloody enterprise, in fact, is there to go and say, yes, we've done a survey of the competences of the ordinary people, and we found them lacking. And then anyone who dares to speak out has to fit into a sort of taxonomy of like deniers, motivated reasoners, and just bad actors. So this is much of this stuff has this sort of disinformation, this preoccupation with disinformation emerges out of psychologists trying to build a taxonomy of the arguments that people use against this form of politics. And the implication seems to be that once you've created a taxonomy of your enemies or your critics' arguments, you don't have to deal with those arguments. You can say, oh yes, you're I don't know if you ever come across these blowhards on the internet who will involve themselves in discussion only to the extent that they'll say, here's your argument, and this is logical fallacy, and they'll give the Latin name of the of the logical fallacy, and then you'll go, well, actually, I don't see the resemblance of the argument with the logical fallacy, and they're just sort of making stuff up. But it's the same principle. You create a taxonomy, and then you go and give all your little minions the taxonomy, and you say, oh yes, this argument is a conspiracy theory. And what turns out, like a lot of these psychologists I've sort of vaguely engaged with, they read any challenge to authority as a conspiracy theory. If you say that your study is motivated by bad faith, that's a conspiracy theory. If you say that the scientists involved aren't competent, that's a conspiracy theory. If you say that their methodology is inappropriate, that's a conspiracy theory, because everything appears to them as a conspiracy theory, because it's a challenge to the authority of the ivory towers. You don't get very far in these debates with these people, because they've got you're a specimen to them, not a peer.
The pathologization of dissent. You know, what particular cognitive defect do you have? Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh.
The only reason, this is where the comparison with Soviet Russia comes in, is that it was mad to challenge the authority of the Soviet Union from within, because the consequences would be so grave. So they said, you must be mad to challenge us.
It's a catch-22.
We're going to really hurt you.
Yeah. You would be crazy to challenge it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Obviously they're not rounding people up. They're not shooting people in the back of the head down a dark alleyway and, you know, what have so on and so forth. Well, not yet. Anyway, God knows where it's going
to
go.
Well, character assassination seems to do the trick up to this point, doesn't it? When we bring this subject up, I will just direct people once again to this article itself. Please do read it. It has a lot of very interesting information, including a fact that I probably did know at some point, but which I had forgotten, was, as you pointed out, who wrote the book on Nudge back in 2008? Oh, Cass Sunstein, who will be very familiar to my listeners with regards to a paper that he wrote around the same time about cognitive infiltration of conspiracy theory groups and how to seed proper information into them to get them into disarray so that the government can do whatever it wants, etc., etc. Yes, I forgot about Cass Sunstein's role in all of that, particularly in the idea of Nudge. So,
yeah, the great thing about Cass Sunstein in this debate, I was always hoping someone would put it together with respect to conspiracy theories, is the UK publisher of one of Cass Sunstein's books is located on the road I grew up in. Right. Coincidences happen, guys. And I always wondered whether someone would say, Ben Parr, he was born in a house which is on a road where Cass Sunstein's books are published. And
I was just about to reveal that. Oh,
damn. Yeah. he's caused a lot of trouble, hasn't he? But it's crap. It became, I say in the article, the operating manual of the British establishment, right? And it became the orthodox. And it's just like that. He wrote it, and then it looks like the whole of the civil service went, wow, we can, I came at this pretty, the climate debate quite green, as it were. I had been a green, but I mean, as in green, as in naive, right? So I thought the best of the academia. You know, I didn't really realize the depth to which it had sort of trashed itself, and I believed in the good faith of science and so on, and then I kept finding involvement. Between, for example, we had the in the government, they set up a new department in around 2008 called the Department for Energy and Climate Change. And I'd look at the minutes and who was there. And they'd have all these psychologists. And it took me ages to understand why that would be. And why would someone who's sort of studying which way rats go around a maze, or you know, what are the mechanisms of pain and so on, so why would they be there? Why would they? It turns out that they're just propagandists, right? They're just paper thin justifications for their being there. It's like we've got to get people to behave.
Mm.
We've got to dispense with democracy
The surfeit of democracy is our biggest problem, right?
Yeah. And academia had just over the era or before, for a long time, perhaps just large parts of academia had developed, adapted itself merely to service government's agenda. So they're no longer speaking truth to power. They're speaking truth, official truth, for official power. So these are people, psychologists should be attacking governments from academia. They're saying this is wrong, you shouldn't be doing this. But actually there seems to be no skeptical climate psychologists other than Jordan Peterson. There's a great video of him saying the problem is all of the right-wing psychologists are in this room, sitting in this chair, right? You know, there's no diversity of opinion, and that very fact alone doesn't trouble climate psychology, and it's quite happy to be the service. The spy bee you mentioned earlier, I think that was headed by psychologist Susan Michie, who just happens to be like a Maoist or a Stalinist. She's a member of the British Communist Party. I don't know which sect, but nonetheless, that says something. I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that psychologists are quite happy with the idea of governments hiring shrinks to manipulate the masses as though they were some kind of tabula rasa. who could be just sort of molded into whatever shape the government needs, and then for that to not raise huge questions in academia. Why aren't academics challenging? And that, I argue, is how we can know that climate change is BS, whether or not climate change is real, right? This climate change has created, is evacuated all of these sort of principles and ethics and establishment ideas that gave us respect for those institutions, that wanted for those institutions to be part of society to make decisions. So I that's a tragedy.
It really is. I will never forget interviewing the late, great Dr. Timball at his home in Victoria back in 2009. And after a lengthy, hours-long conversation that we had on the history of science and the philosophy of science, and in which he demonstrated his love of science and his familiarity with the subject of science, and then him lamenting that one of the worst facets of this perversion of science in the name of this global warming net zero agenda is that it is tarnishing science itself. And yeah, Here we are 15 years later, and yes, unfortunately, that's never been more true than it is right now. Ben, we could talk about this for hours, but I think we'll have to draw this conversation to a conclusion at some point. So why not now? But before we go, how can people access your work? What's the best place for them to go find more about these subjects?
I'm on Twitter, if you like that stuff. It gets a bit rough and ready, doesn't it? It's like kind of digital street fighting these days. And Climate Resistance, CLIM8 Resistance. I'm at climatedebate.co.uk, and that's our sort of attempt to form a response to all of this stuff, and to put debate back at the. It's a bit of a campaign, an attempt to sort of put debate back at the center of the policy agenda, the climate discussion. And as you say, I'm at netzeroscandal.substack.com. That's going to be, we've got YouTube videos at various places across those sites. I think that's kind of also at the Daily Skeptic, of course. You'll see a couple of articles from me there every week, hopefully for the foreseeable future.
Excellent. Well, as I say, I'll be linking all of that, including, of course, the article that we were focusing on today, in the show notes for people who need those links. And I hope this will not be our last conversation. Ben Pyle, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.